Before jumping into the material of the episode, I would like to reiterate my appreciation for hero lore is the result of many who have influenced me with their own knowledge. Family members, friends, teachers, professors, authors, movie directors. Whenever possible, I strive to reference those peoples or sources in which a particular idea originates that I then expound on in the podcast or in my written material. Like anyone else, my individual ideas are not the result of strictly memorizing others' ideas, but by applying inference, pattern recognition, and inspiration to the ideas and histories of others, as well as my own, the same way that we all produce our own particular thoughts. Of course, I've had numerous discussions with many people on what then later ended up being topics of a podcast. Some of the ideas I've been enlightened to arose out of conversations with others. Now, I'm actually a fanatic when it comes to people receiving proper recognition for work that comes from their hands and the thoughts that come from their minds. So you may see me striving to grant such recognition to individuals. In doing so, the recognition may come at a cost of a fluid dialogue in the podcast, but I'd prefer that over the appearance of my own questionable integrity. So on that point, many people have actually asked me who were some individuals that have influenced my thoughts. When it comes to mythology and hero lore, there are three. In the prior podcast, I mentioned Dr. Carl Jung. The second is the author and professor Joseph Campbell. His assessments of mythical culture in books like his popular Hero with a Thousand Faces have helped me to advance my knowledge of and refine my ideas on heroic similarities. What Campbell actually refers to as the monomyth. Point of interest here about Campbell, George Lucas gave Campbell significant credit for the influence his monomyth concepts made on the stories and characters of the Star Wars saga. The third individual is psychologist and professor Dr. Jordan Peterson. Now, some may hear his name and think that I've just associated myself with a right-wing radical. And if, as a listener, you just had that response, I'd actually recommend you read or listen to his books and podcast, as well as consider listening to the marital and relationship advice that he offers through the Daily Wire media platform. Now, it's his courage and his knowledge that have placed him in the intellectual limelight of some of today's biggest moral dilemmas. But as I've listened to him, it's actually his love of mankind, his desire to enable the potential of others, especially those who are brokenhearted, that I find most speaks to the goodness of Dr. Peterson's character. Those familiar with Jordan Peterson may hear some similarities to his mythical and psychological analysis in my productions. Now, he's definitely made an impact on my expression of ideas, especially those of the psychological aspect. That being said, my alignment with Dr. Peterson's thoughts are not strictly because I read his works or listened to his podcast and decided, hey, I agree with this guy. In fact, it was actually just the opposite. It wasn't actually until the middle of 2020, so already 18 months into my experience with severe depression and suicidal ideation, that I began to even look into the works of Jordan Peterson. What immediately drew me to his material was that he was explaining the psychological terrors of my own experience and relating them through mythological and religious themes, as if they were connected. It was the very same concept I had been cognitively treating myself with for the prior 25 years. So, as far as Dr. Peterson's influence on what I talk about in the podcast or in my writings, it is something of a chicken-egg scenario. So that someone might question me whether I developed an idea or was it that I was just using Jordan Peterson's ideas applied to my own situation, to which then I could truthfully answer, yes. Either way, Dr. Jordan Peterson deserves recognition for his brilliance in intellect, in courage, and in spirit that actually enhanced the meaningfulness of my own trials and many others. Welcome back to another Bruised episode. This will be the second episode in our Hero Code series. So if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to our Hero Code introduction, you're going to want to go back and listen to that podcast first. Before we jump off in this podcast, it won't make sense to you unless you've actually listened to that episode. So with that said, I'll actually pose a question that I posed at the end of the last episode. That question is this. Is there a trial or conflict that you would not pray to God for help because you believe that it was outside of his realm of influence? Personally, I can't think of anything that is out of God's realm of influence. But what that means to me is that there is no event after which I could ask God, hey, why did this happen? To which he then could not provide a productive answer. In essence, there is no why God that I could ask him to which he could not provide an adequate, well, because Todd, this, and this. It's for this reason that I pose that why God, why is a representative phrase for conflict, for chaos and disorder, for the appearance of all that is unknown to us. Now, one may wonder, why would I pick such an odd phrase to represent conflict? It for sure complicates the process of explaining an already big concept. But of the straw poll that I've taken of people who are in despair, why tops the list of most important questions to ask God? Now, as a representative phrase, why God, why is only a shorthand substitute for a variety of different expressions that announce chaos and disorder. Just like riding off into the sunset is an easy substitute for happily ever after. Why God, why is equally expressed by similar phrases such as, dear God, or what is happening? Or excuse the expression, what the hell? There is actually an innumerable amount of statements, euphemisms, even facial expressions that serve the general purpose and meaning of why God, why? Going forward, for the sake of simplicity, I'll refer to this meaningful group of statements as whys, unless otherwise needed for clarification. Now, it may seem that the application of why God, why is merely limited to expressions of shock. It is not. Why God, as a sincere question, also encompasses statements of profound substance. And in fact, it is actually the transition of a character's whys from emotionally reflexive statements of stress to then sincere questions of productive inquiry that we should be most interested in. Because that transition, it reveals exactly what makes the difference between the everyman that stumbles into chaos and the hero that emerges from it. In that transition is the opportunity to learn, if one chooses to learn, how to actuate what enables our potential. So with that said, let's get a bit more tangible with our whys so you can see what I mean. Now, I stated a character's whys goes through a transition. That is to say that whys sit on a spectrum between two poles or types. On one end, you have statements of shock. These whys are early onset in the introduction of a story's chaos and are actually more rhetorical than they are inquisitive. The dear gods or what the hell? These whys are emotionally expressive. Their purpose is as a reflexive stress release. They're an instinctive announcement that one's world has changed and suddenly changed forever, but that the person uttering the phrase is not yet ready to comprehend the change that is occurring. An example of this would be the character Ebenezer Scrooge from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Now, I select this character and story because the work is well known. And not just well known, but a good segment of Christians renew their familiarity with the story once every 12 months. So again, an example of a why of the reflexive stress type is the manner in which Scrooge reacts to his first haunting visitor, the spirit of his previous business partner, Jacob Marley. His why God why here is in the form of the words, tell me. The reflexive stress response is apparent in his naive request. Quote, "Old Jacob Marley, tell me more. Speak comfort to me, Jacob," close quote. To which Jacob, a representation of God's will, responds that he has none to give. Scrooge doesn't understand the meaning of Jacob's visit. His concern at this early point in the chaos is purely of self-interest. Because of his ignorance, Scrooge actually thinks it's appropriate to dictate to Jacob that whatever is in store for him, that the experience be pleasant. Now, this is an example of a protagonist trying to make meaning of something far beyond the comprehension early on in the chaos. The request is shallow, and it reflects just how little substance Scrooge has when it comes to matters of comfort and discomfort. Whys become progressively more substantial throughout a story, and that is because the character becomes more mentally productive over the time and experience of their journey. Ebenezer Scrooge follows this pattern. Following Jacob's haunting, and after a full hour spent with a second spirit, Scrooge is visited by a third ghost, a spirit that shows Scrooge how things currently stand among the people he interacts with. After seeing the sickly state of his employee's son, Tiny Tim, Scrooge asks his spirit guide, quote, "Spirit, tell me if Tiny Tim will live," close quote. The spirit informs Scrooge that unless something changes, Tiny Tim won't see another Christmas day. And then Dickens smoothly uses the dialogue of the spirit to show the reader the progress Scrooge is making by quoting words that Scrooge himself spoke just the day prior. The spirit of Christmas present echoes Scrooge's words, quote, "If he be like to die, he'd better do it and decrease the surplus population," close quote. To which Dickens relates Ebenezer's reaction to his own cruel words. Quote, "Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted by the spirit and was overcome with penitence and grief," close quote. Note, through Scrooge's inquiry, though much improved upon, it is still not productive as it concerns himself. Now, essentially, the question Scrooge asks is absent any intervention or act he personally might make. Remember, the question was, "Spirit, tell me if Tiny Tim will live." Meaning that Scrooge has yet to ask whys that require him to act. Whys that might require him to sacrifice or change. So a protagonist rarely makes the jump from whys of a purely reactive, self-centered nature to whys of a purely productive sort. The process of change is gradual, and gradual by necessity. So it is in storytelling as it is in life, that the productive end of the why spectrum usually occurs only after a prolonged period of discomfort. Long suffering is an apt term for this part of the process. In the case of Ebenezer Scrooge, only when he encounters a spirit whose presence causes dread and whose mode of communication is cold and dismissive, the spirit, for example, uses only pointing of his finger to direct Scrooge's progress. It's only in the presence of this specter that the whys of Scrooge really begin to take on productive substance. The phantom, as Scrooge refers to it, eventually guides him to a cemetery, a place that intensifies the discomfort of Scrooge. Once there, it's as if the increased discomfort then accelerates Scrooge's ability to process and verbalize principles of good character, because he then articulates this, quote, "Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if preserved in, they must lead," said Scrooge. "But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me." The spirit was immovable as ever. Close quote. Now at this point, a quick notion to share. It is said that necessity is the mother of invention. I propose that suffering is the mother of the hero. In the example of Scrooge, he has spent the night in intense psychological distress. He's been haunted by ghosts, He's also vividly relived moments of his past that elicited severe regret within him. He's also viewed people he has stewardship over living in miserable circumstances, in good part because of his willing neglect. But it is only after his previous statement in which he reveals the knowledge he's gained that Scrooge is then truly tested. Scrooge now experiences the most intense terror of the entire night. The Phantom directs Scrooge towards a headstone in the cemetery. Quote, Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name, Ebenezer Scrooge. The finger pointed from the grave to him and back again. No, spirit. Oh, no. No. The finger was still there. Spirit, he cried, clutching at its robes. Hear me. I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for this intercourse. Why show me this if I am past all hope? For the first time, the hand, meaning the hand of the Phantom, appeared to shake. Good spirit, he pursued, as down upon the ground he fell before it. Your nature intercedes for me and pities me. Assure me that I yet may change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life. The kind hand, again the spirit's hand, trembled. Scrooge continues, I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may sponge away the writing on this stone. In his agony, he caught the spectral hand. It sought to free itself, but he was strong in his entreaty and detained it. The spirit, stronger yet, repulsed him. Holding up his hands in a last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the Phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. Close quote. Prolonged agony or intense suffering performs the role of activating agent that enables change. By definition, a hero requires change, or at least something that sets him apart from the common man, something that sets himself apart from his own character appearing at the beginning of the story. Prolonged pain often acts as a precursor to humility, and humility is the substrate for productive questioning, so that a long-suffered hero, dipped in humility, begins to change his dialogue with God. A wise and humble hero begins to ask a why, God, why, that holds meaning more along the lines of, all right, I've learned to embrace the change and the pain. Now what is needed? Or, okay, God, I get it. I'm ready. Teach me. This is actually God's method for making heroes of us. The heroes that our current selves wish we were. The heroes that he intends us to be. He follows a pattern. Suffering, humility, learning, change, which then makes strength. Ether, chapter 12, verse 27. And if men come unto me, I will show unto them their weakness. I give unto men weakness that they may be humble. And my grace is sufficient for all men that humble themselves before me. For if they humble themselves before me and have faith in me, then will I make weak things become strong unto them. Does that not sound like the classic hero's journey? Is that not the difference between who we are today and the heroes we desire to be? In reality, the consummate difference between the pre-conflict individual and the accomplished hero is work. Things like faith, repentance, change, adjustments, whatever. But work in some form previously not achieved by the protagonist. uncomfortable work, I'd call it. Uncomfortable work achieved over a period of time. What I believe is the genuine value meant by long-suffering as a character trait. Now, there is another word defined as work over time. In the field of physics, work is performed when one object acts upon another in such a way that the object acted upon is displaced. Or in other words, the object acted upon must move for the act to be considered work. Work of this sort, performed over a period of time, is what we refer to as power. Now, the dimensions of work performed by mental effort and physical effort are nowhere near directly translatable. But it takes little imagination to understand that an individual who has endured an extended period of significant stress has increased their power. Put some thought to the socially implied power of the following two people before and after their challenges. Who's more powerful? Nelson Mandela in 1962, before his imprisonment? Or Nelson Mandela in 1990, freed from prison after a period of almost 28 years. From that point, in 4 years, he becomes President Mandela. Now, becoming president of a country is pretty impressive, but it's much more than that, because think about it. How many presidents of African nations, past or present, can you name off the top of your head? That's powerful. The second person. Who's more powerful? Elizabeth Smart, a 14-year-old girl living comfortably with her family in Salt Lake City, Utah, in June of 2002, before she is abducted, forced into marriage, and kept captive for 9 months, or the Elizabeth Smart any time after June 5th, 2002, but especially after she makes the choice to transform her captive experience and the lifelong mental hauntings of it to bless others. And she does this by, and this is an impressive list for even someone who's not been abducted, by one, writing a book about her journey. Two, serving a mission in France, no less. Three, establishing a foundation to help alleviate and prevent the pain of others caused by sexual assault. And four, which I think may have actually required more work of her than any of the above accomplishments, considering the psychosocial effects of sexual assault. She is married and she has children. The point here is that regardless of our ability to quantify mental effort, long suffering is like power in its own sphere of influence. Now, obviously, we use the fictional character Ebenezer Scrooge as an example to exhibit how both types of wise, emotionally reactive and productively purposeful, are used in storytelling. Also, using the same character's dialogue, we show that depending on the sequencing of a why in proximity to the conflict and disorder, its meaning shifts between its two poles of purpose. So that the productivity of the wise asked by a hero increases in harmony with the substance of that hero's character. Now, why? Why? The word why in question form is a request for purpose or meaning, which is interesting because why questions often become apparent during times of significant strife. And they continue until the protagonist of the tell has fully undergone a change of character. Take note that this phenomenon of whys occurring in combination with the subject's change of character occurs again, not just in fictional lore, but also in real life. And you can use yourself as an example for this. Think for a moment. Have you ever used the phrase, why God, why, in your mind, or even out loud? What was the occasion? I'd be willing to bet that you just recalled either one, a tragedy, yours personally, or that of someone very close to you, or two, a significant destructive event that resulted in suffering on a mass scale. Whatever it was, you probably thought of something or someone meaningful to you, something life-altering, something precious. Now, as I continue on with this, strange I know, I'd actually like to point out examples of events that you did not recall. You probably didn't think about an aged relative who dealt with a mild illness for an extended period of time, who then eventually died. Even less likely, you probably didn't recall a time of surprising benefit where, for example, your name was drawn at random to win some remarkable prize. And you didn't think about these because, for some reason, meaning is not really important to us when it comes to events that go to plan. That even includes things that are sad, like that old relative of yours that you expected to die. And the same goes for events that we don't anticipate that invoke a positive emotional reaction within us. Now, sure, someone may wonder to themselves why God would grant them such good fortune, but it's not likely that you'll find someone engaging in self-harm because they won the lottery and they then can't understand why God would allow such good fortune to happen to them. Now, those ideas may seem obvious, self-evident, but I make the point for a reason. That we might appreciate our deep need for purpose and meaning, and that this need for purpose and meaning is greatest when we or our loved ones encounter the most gut-wrenching moments of our lives. Those moments when your torment, whatever its source, whatever its categorical conflict type, compels you to ask, why, God? Why? Why me? Why now? Why this particular trial? Why the productive word, the request for meaning? It's become sacred to me. It represents my own most vulnerable experiences, the extended periods of time I spent roaming the unknown. In my case, the unknown being the mental state I experienced during my battle with treatment-resistant depression. A mental state there's no way I could have fathomed before crossing its borders, but one in which I became enlightened to by asking why. Now, on that point, some people would believe that the time I spent in the unknown of depression was a result of my own personal poor choices, and that the whys I asked and the answers I received during that time should not be encouraged, because the realm I inhabited was, in their opinion, under the influence of the adversary. Now, I will concede that my mental state was a dark place, especially when compared to the cultural optimism that was customary to many of those people who were around me. But I would respectfully counter that the darkness was not the result of an evil nature of the distress I experienced, but instead, it was like living in an unexplored habitat, or one very few have actually explored. The depths of the ocean might be an example. Most understand only the dangers of a melancholy mind, correlating the exploration of being depressed with something like spiritual death, when in reality, the very few who have braved those waters have come to understand that despite the very real dangers that are there, those depths, that dark unknown, that melancholy journey, it's a genuine aspect of life. A life worth living. One that actually molds the people who visit it into a highly resilient nature. And it nurtures an enlightened perspective. Now, having lived myself in a state of prolonged emotional darkness, I have a profound knowledge of what to most is unknown. Without doubt, what knowledge I gained came at a significant cost. A good part of who I was before my journey is now dead. That part, the part that died, it couldn't survive the environment it was subjected to. The part of me that did survive was the part that housed a lot of my boldness and grit. Those characteristics have both been amplified. Admittedly, not always in a good way. But another trait survived along with the grit and the boldness in a way that was not at all what was expected. This trait like my boldness and grit, also emerged amplified by the experience, which is strange because I thought that it would have diminished or that it may have even died. But the one trait that the darkness unquestionably sealed to my heart was my belief in God. It sounds counterintuitive. The darkness illuminating one's conviction in God. But it did. Finding utility in my own suffering gave me a perspective of Christ as the hero that I could not have obtained otherwise. It is his willful suffering above all things that makes him divine. Since returning from that emotional state 3 years ago, there has been one principle of knowledge that I felt perpetually compelled to share, but as much as I've tried, I've not been able to find the adequate balance of words to share it. And in truth, with this particular podcast, I've spent several months working on this episode alone. I've actually had all other parts completed for weeks, but of the 20 plus different endings from this point on I've attempted, not one comes near to articulating what I really mean. And then, middle of the night, between Saturday and Sunday, I woke up with the answer. And sadly, it's going to need its own episode. But the source of inspiration is a talk called Happy and Forever, which actually seems contradictory to the suffering is divine theme I've got going on. Yet, it's oddly complementary to my use of mythical motifs. The talk itself was given to a worldwide audience last October by Elder Garrett W. Gong, a general leader of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And to kind of kick things off so that you can anticipate what's coming next, I'll read the first paragraphs of his talk just to get you ready for what we'll tackle next. Elder Gong states, "Friends, dear brothers and sisters, do you remember believing or wanting to believe in happily ever after? Then life happens. We grow up. Relationships get complicated. This world is noisy, crowded, pushy, with pretense and posturing. Yet, in our deep heart's core, we believe or want to believe somewhere, somehow, happy and forever are real and possible. Happy and forever are not the imaginary stuff of fairy tales. True, enduring joy and eternity with those we love are the very essence of God's plan of happiness. His lovingly prepared way can make our eternal journey happy and forever." With that stated, we'll close off this episode.